Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife. We're at day two of the Trauma Critical Care and Acute Care Surgery Conference. It's just been an amazing conference so far. We've been having a fantastic time. You know, we should have mentioned this earlier, but we really want to give a lot of credit to the East TraumaCast for their support in getting us here, both in getting us to the meeting physically and in arranging some of these great interviews. If you haven't had a chance to check out the TraumaCast, I would definitely do that. It's a fantastic podcast, trauma related, you know, all the latest, stuff out of the trauma world. So today we're going to have some more of the panel discussions like we had yesterday, discussing some of the, you know, the hot and more controversial issues within trauma and acute care surgery. So enjoy.
Okay, so finishing up our third session, we just had another wonderful time and a great panel. So we have two guests here. I'd ask you guys to just introduce yourself, where you're from, and then we'll delve right into it.
I'm Allison Wilson. I'm the Division Director of Trauma, Acute Care Surgery, and Critical Care at West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia.
And my name is Carlos Brown. I'm the Chief of Trauma at Dell Medical School, University of Texas at Austin.
So, Allison, we'll start with you. You had a great talk about a lot of the soft tissue infections and some of the things we've seen. One of the classic things that comes up oftentimes is, what do you do about the patient that you're sure has got something going on a little bit, but you think it's just a cellulitis? And we talked a little bit about the panel about who you image, who you don't image. I know your principles that you said were, if you have any doubt, just take them to the operating room. But we know that there's problems, and there are people, we have listeners from all around the world, there's problems with just getting a patient to the hospital. So when do you decide to image? What comes up, and what are some of the principal take-home messages for our listeners out there about soft tissue infections in general?
So I think one is differentiating between a cellulitis and a fasciitis. And so again, one of the key things is if you passively move the leg or the extremity and there's a tremendous amount of pain in that muscle group, you have to be suspicious that there's something deeper. Now, if they're not systemically sick and you want to image those people, that's fine. However, if they show any signs of toxicity, fever, tachycardia, oliguria, confusion, and in the face of a tender muscle group or anything else that looks like necrotizing fasciitis, just take them to the operating room. You can make an incision, cut down in the area, and then look at the fascia and look to see if there's any dead subcutaneous tissue as well.
One thing I was interested by that you talked about was the necrotizing cellulitis. Mm-hmm. So again, these are patients that you're pretty sure they don't have fasciitis. They're not systemically sick, but they may still need debridement. So when you're looking at that patient, that it's the medicine team consulting, you think it's a cellulitis. How do you make that decision that I'm going to make an incision on this person?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of times in those people, I'll look to see, is there any signs of that the skin is. So if it's just red and indurated, then the tissue underneath is at least blottable, then a lot of times I'll see how they do with 24 hours of antibiotics. However, if you're starting to get blistering of the skin at all, even just one or two little dots of it, or it's that thick, hard, woody type of subcutaneous tissue, I'll take those people to the operating room and debride them. And the error you want to avoid is just making a solitary incision as you would for an abscess, because it's not an abscess. You got to get around until you get to healthy, bleeding subcutaneous tissue.
So, question to the both of you. What is your preferred antibiotic regimen? How broad spectrum do you go? How broad spectrum? And have you ever had to add any other weird things like antifungals or antivirals or anything like that?
So definitely it tends to be, if we think it's clostridial, then you're going to use a penicillin base. But in reality, using those principles of sepsis, hit them big, hit them hard, broad spectrum antibiotics at first until you really have an idea or a designation of what it is. And then, yes, I have, particularly in the big wounds or the ones that are immunosuppressed, and it's not something that you can get control over and have to take and able to get some soft tissue coverage in a reasonable amount of time. I've certainly seen fungal infections that then develop on top of that.
I think this is really a time to use your local antibiogram. I mean, I know we all have, we say broad spectrum antibiotics, but that may be different in my institution than your institution. And I also get the I get the ICU pharmacists involved extremely early in these cases and get their input, because the local antibiogram has a necrotizing soft tissue infection algorithm that we use, and we use those antibiotics. But I think also that ICU pharmacist rounds with us every day, and having their input on the cultures and the antibiotics and see how things are going, it's really an essential part of the team in this situation.
What about coverage for your resistant organisms? So your MRSA or VRE, do you empirically start that? How do you know when to turn them off?
So, you know, I do empirically start with MRSA and VRE, particularly MRSA coverage. You know, really, you got to look at the infection, the etiology. If it is a Fournier's gangrene and somebody who's been somewhat sick and they've had multiple infections in the past, particularly urinary tract infections, then VRE you have to be very suspect of. However, if it's somebody who, you know, it's a young, healthy college kid who was out hiking and now they're sick, it's probably going to be a group A strep. So you really have to look at what is the patient population, where's the infection. If it's Ludwig's angina, then it's going to be oral types of bacteria. So not always, it's actually a low part of the population where it is an MRSA or a VRE that's actually the etiology of it.
We do cover for MRSA on everybody. However, VRE, we don't have a lot of VRE in our institution. It wouldn't be an initial coverage for necrotizing soft tissue infections unless they were not getting better or you cultured it out.
Carlos, I'll start with you first, but I want to hear both of you. So you get called for Fournier's gangrene. You do your debridement. When do you decide to bring up a diverting colostomy on these patients? Is that in your algorithm at all? Does that even fall within the thing? We get asked this question a lot, and is there certain factors you look at, or by and large, do you not worry about that?
Well, I think it depends on how, you know, what the perianal area looks like specifically after the debridement, right? I mean, there's debridements for Fournier's gangrene or necrotizing soft tissue of the perineum that are perianal completely, and some that are relatively far away from that. And it really depends on what it looks like. That being said, colostomy is nowhere in my algorithm in the first few days, right? This is here debridement, infection control, source control. The colostomy can wait, you know, 3, 4, 5 days down the road. When it's going to be pretty clear that the wound's not going to heal without a colostomy, then at one of the takebacks, we'll do a laparoscopic diverting sigmoid colostomy.
So to both of you, but particularly Dr. Wilson, you talked about a little tip and trick that I'd never seen in practice before that was very interesting to me, and that was the sulfamylon soaks for these type of injuries. Can you talk about that? And then also, how do you know when the wound bed is ready to take a wound vac?
So the sulfamylon I learned from an old burn surgeon who was president of the American Burn Association for a long time. He says it kills everything. And so actually the first time we used it was on a young girl who was, this was her leukemia blast crisis, and she was just dying. And so the sulfamylon is a soak. You don't see the metabolic acidosis. It's easy to use. It's 50 grams and 1 liter of fluid. And what I'll do is cover the bed with a gauze. We choose to use the burn dressings, but any type of gauze cling will work. And then I put red rubber catheters and hook it up to bags of this, and then constantly irrigate the wound bed over that period of time, so 6-12 hours, and then it usually helps. And it's actually shortened the number of debridements I've had to do compared to what we used to do beforehand when it was just wet to dries.
Now what about Dakin's?
Oh, I think Dakin's is great too. I think that's certainly very workable. I think that's a very reasonable thing to do.
What do you do with all that effluent, though? Is it just going in the patient's bed? Or are you just laying chucks down? Or, I mean, how often are you changing the dressings? I mean, obviously we have people going from medical students up to chairman of surgery here, as I always say. So walk me through. I'm a resident, and they like this tip and trick. They're going to go to their attending and say, okay, I got to write an order. So 50, and that's fine, but you're going to say drip in at what rate? And what is the actual technical aspects of this?
So we'll actually drip it in. We'll run it at 100 cc's per hour per drain, so it gets very wet and very moist. What we do is work with the nurses ahead of time, and there is an absorbent flooring that you can put down on the on the OR when you're expecting a bad trauma, or they also sometimes use it for cysto. We'll lay that on the bed to protect the bed, and then put multiple chucks. So as things get wet or moist, you can pull that away so the patient's skin isn't staying moist or getting macerated. So with that, you know, we usually only have to do this for, you know, 1, 12, 24 hours, and if it gets us and kills the bacteria, then if the wound bed is clean and we don't have to keep doing further debridements, then we can stop and change over to the wound vac.
What are your experience with the infusion wound vacs? Have you used those at all? I know they're kind of a hot topic now, and people are starting to use them more.
Yes, and I have had good luck and good experience, and I'll use sulfamylon in the VersaFlow wound vac and the infusion wound vac. I think it can work very, very well. The issue that I've had, like for the example of the patient that we took all the subcutaneous tissue off from the base of the neck all the way to the rectus, all the way to the the pelvis inlet, and then all the way to the spine, it's just not big enough. And so in that case, it just kind of depends on the logistics. But I think that those are reasonable, and I think we've had good luck with it working well, but you can easily use sulfamylon in those as well.
I think my take on these wounds is a little bit different. Hundreds and thousands of ways to manage these wounds, and my take is do the least amount possible that can control the situation. So I just do wet to dries with saline, and then I will go to a vac when I no longer have to debride any dead tissue. So I feel like the infection's controlled. I'm not debriding dead tissue. I'll put a vac on then. But I use just wet to dries with saline and just a simple vac, because if you get 1,000 people, you're going to get 10,000 opinions on what to do. I just think the more simple, the better.
So institutional type question to the both of you. Now walk me through, you've done your debridement, the patient is now stabilized, and now you got a wound. Obviously it depends on the side of the wound, but when you get plastics involved, how soon do you start to, when you're thinking about skin grafting versus trying to put it together, primarily, all of those type of reconstructive type issues?
I think if it's a small-ish wound, we'll just do the skin graft ourselves. If they're starting to, you have to rotate local flaps for fornays, if you have to cover testicles, things like that, we'll get plastics involved at the second or third debridement, when we start saying we're getting close and we're going to be done with our debridement, get them involved early in that. And they can do some pretty amazing stuff locally, moving tissue and not end up requiring much of a skin graft. But I think plastics is a critical part of this team as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I think having plastics involved is very, very helpful. And it depends on wound location. So something that's even a sizable wound, but it's along the chest wall or it's along a static part of the abdomen or along the arm, that's one thing. But if you cross a joint, or if you're in an area that needs to be fairly flexible, such as the pelvis for Fourniers, or you've got exposed other things like vessels, nerves, and things, then I get plastics involved, because some of the advanced wound techniques and utilization of Integra and skin flaps may be needed.
Okay, switching gears a little bit, Dr. Brown, you gave a great talk on necrotizing pancreatitis and a step-up approach to the management. Briefly, if you could just take us through some of the basics. These are patients the surgeon typically doesn't see until it's very advanced and they're very sick. But briefly, how you approach that patient with regard to nutrition in the patient with severe pancreatitis, and what do you do with the patient that maybe on the CT scan you just see a little bit of peripancreatic fluid, maybe 20-25% necrosis of the pancreas.
Mm-hmm. So the thing to keep in mind, I think, is the majority of cases of pancreatitis can be managed without anything significant, no surgery. Probably 80% are going to be mild to moderate and self-limited. It's that 20% of severe pancreatitis that we're talking about. And so for the mild cases, it's going to be hydration, pain control, and observation. For the more severe cases, you're going to do fluid resuscitation, nutrition, and then management of local complications. Fluid resuscitation is going to be crystalloid resuscitation, probably lactated Ringers, looks like it might be better, 250 cc's to 500 cc's per hour, targeting a urine output goal of half a cc per kilo per hour. Nutrition should be enteral, start after patient's resuscitated, preferably in the 24 to 72 hour range. Traditionally, we use the nasal jejunal route. It looks like now we can do nasogastric feeds, and you have the same sort of outcome, same feeding tolerance and so on. And then managing local complications. Peripancreatic fluid collections can be observed. Pancreatic necrosis can be observed. The real question is, do we have infected necrosis? That's really the kind of the change in algorithm. Is the patient having infected necrosis? And infected necrosis is diagnosed if you see air in the retroperitoneum, or if you suspect someone who's not getting better, who's got peripancreatic fluid collections, you can send a sample off for Gram staining culture. If it shows infected necrosis, then you start antibiotics, and then the debridement, in the step-up approach, will be percutaneous drainage followed by debridement if they don't get better. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll ask this to the both of you. So in the absence of those two things, so it seems like this was a debate when I was a resident. So when do you start antibiotics? I know you mentioned the air right there, but simple patient, their white count's kind of going up, but they're otherwise stable, and this whole idea of, and then what antibiotics do you start when you do start those antibiotics?
And again, it's really changed, and there's a lot of controversy around this, but
And Carlos, one other thing that I want to make sure that I ask the question right. So can you start antibiotics in the absence of getting a sample without a percutaneous?
Yes. You start antibiotics, in my opinion right now, you start antibiotics when you have the diagnosis of infected necrosis, not before that. So the presence of pancreatic necrosis is not an indication for prophylactic antibiotics. When you make the diagnosis of infected necrosis, you start antibiotics. And you make that diagnosis one of two ways. You see air in the retroperitoneum, that's infected necrosis, or you send a sample and you get a gram stain with bacteria, that's infected necrosis. That's not right now, in my opinion, the indication for antibiotics is the presence of infected necrosis.
I would certainly agree with that, although I will tell you in our institution, a fair number of these patients will be on the medicine service and they'll already have been on antibiotics. But I do think that the literature's quite clear that infected necrosis is the indication, and not all patients, just because they have a SIRS response, need to be on antibiotics.
In what antibiotics?
So we tend to use a combination of the extended beta-lactamase inhibitors and plus or minus the addition of linezolid or vancomycin.
Yeah, again, antibiogram, usually meropenem or imipenem.
So I was wondering, Dr. Brown, if you could talk to us about a technique that you talked about, which is the retroperitoneal videoscopic approach to a necrosectomy with pancreatic necrosis or infected pancreatic necrosis. Can you just kind of walk us through some principles of that and how to utilize that?
Yeah, so if somebody, the step-up approach, you know, it's going to be antibiotics, PERC drainage, and probably a repeat PERC drainage. And if they have failed that and they're continuing to be sick, you're going to do a surgical debridement. The two options are open necrosectomy, which I think has now been replaced by video-assisted retroperitoneal debridement, or VARD. And that entails using the previously placed percutaneous drain as your guide to the retroperitoneum. So when I have the radiologist put the drain in, I have him put in subcostal in the left flank, and that's the easiest place, I think, to access the retroperitoneum. So I use that drain. I cut down on the drain through the skin, subcutaneous musculature, until I enter the retroperitoneum and the left pericolic gutter, essentially. And then once I enter that, you get an effluent of purulence and necrotic debris, extend that incision a little bit, and then I take a 10-millimeter laparoscope, 0 degree typically seems to be easier, and I put that into the cavity. And then, like I said, a lot of fluid just comes out when you make the incision. Then I use a Yankauer to get more pus and debris out. And then I start seeing the solid infected necrotic pancreas. And with that, I'll use ring forceps or something along those lines to pull that pancreatic tissue out through that wound. And that wound is not a big wound. It's 8 to 10 centimeters. It's fairly small.
And then what do you do with the wound after that? Do you pack it, or do you just leave it open? Do you sew it all back up?
Yeah, so for the wound, once I've debrided all the pancreas and I'm comfortable, I've got everything out and sucked all the pus out, I usually put one or two flat JP drains, 10-millimeter JP drains, and then close the wound in layers with the expectation that the wound might get infected or is likely to get infected after that. But I close the wound over JPs.
So one of the questions that got asked in the moderator type session of it is, how do you avoid that scary bleeding? And now you're looking down in a hole, and obviously we have some residents and medical students here. So what are you going to ask for? You're sitting in the OR. What do you say to them? Get me what?
If they start bleeding?
Yeah.
You know, that's – so thankfully, in the cases I've done, I've not encountered significant hemorrhage from that. Clearly, the splenic artery are at risk of injury during this procedure. If I get into torrential hemorrhage or something like that, I'm probably going to pack the patient, the retroperitoneum, with laps tightly, like it would for a trauma laparotomy. If it's splenic artery bleeding, pretty apparently, I'll probably take them to angio after that. If it's splenic vein bleeding or venous bleeding, I'll probably just pack them, and that should eventually stop that bleeding. Again, I haven't seen it in practice. I'm sure it happens, but the key is to debriding what comes away easily. Not you shouldn't be pulling away things that are hard or difficult to debride.
And so when I was training, I remember the classic, when we were done here, get me the Abramson sump drains, and we're going to just have continuous irrigation on it. Do you use that anymore?
No, I just use a simple flat JP drain, fenestrated JP 10-millimeter drain.
With that, the Abramson drain is a great thing to use in that necrotizing fasciitis thing.
Yeah.
So, if you want to irrigate with the JP or with the Abramson.
So two very different disease processes, necrotizing pancreatitis and NSTIs, but similar in the fact that they often require extensive debridements for source control. So just to wrap things up, a quick fill in the blank. Then from your guys' perspective, the next greatest thing in infection control for the surgical patient is blank.
Well, mine's not so much for infection control, but I think in dealing with necrotizing soft tissue infections and necrotizing fasciitis is don't delay, go early, don't be afraid. Everyone seems to rely more and more on labs and imaging, and this is really a diagnosis where you can actually save tissue and save lives by intervening earlier.
I think interesting, pancreatitis is probably the opposite. Be patient. These patients are all sick. They're all tachycardic, they're all febrile, they all have white counts, but you really need to be patient and manage them with hydration and nutrition. And if you get infected necrosis, start antibiotics, and even then you need to be patient to go in and operate because you want to have a pancreatic bed that you can debride. If you go in too early, it won't be able to debride it. So I think patients are a little bit different timeline for pancreatitis than for a necrotizing soft tissue infection.
Great. Well, Dr. Brown, Dr. Wilson, thank you for your time. We'd love to have you back on Behind the Knife later for a longer discussion.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, day number two at the Trauma Critical Care and Acute Care Surgery 2016 conference here in Vegas. Just finished up one of the morning sessions, and we're very happy to have a couple of the fellows here from the wonderful panel that we just got done with. So, guys, introduce yourself and just tell the podcast listeners where you're from.
I'm Bilal Joseph from the University of Arizona in Tucson. I'm a trauma, critical care, and emergency general surgeon.
And my name's Rick Sidwell. I'm here from Des Moines, Iowa, and that's what I do also is trauma acute care surgery.
So, Rick, we'll start with you. Just tell, obviously, not everybody on the podcast can have the benefit of hearing kind of what you talked about today. Give a little bit of background, some high points about what you talked about, and maybe some of the more, you know, the idea behind the session this morning was, you know, is it hot, is it hype, what's new, what's old, and kind of some of the more controversial things about your topic.
So I was talking about the use of ultrasound in the emergency room, evaluating the trauma patients. And really the take-home message that I was trying to get across is that ultrasound does have an important role. Its most important role is with the patient who presents in shock, using the ultrasound to establish if the hemorrhage is intra-abdominal, leading you to an operation. Beyond that, you know, it has a lot of advantages and disadvantages, and I think that it should be used in everybody so that we acquire and maintain our skills. But as far as affecting our clinical decision-making, it's really that subset of trauma patients who are presenting in shock. That's the big message that I was trying to get across this morning.
So you spoke a little bit about the use of this and how it varies in different centers. Can you talk a little bit about maybe the rural hospital's use of the EFAS and the FAS and how that affects decision-making, and should they be doing it at all?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and that's a question that I get frequently when I'm, you know, teaching the rural trauma course or teaching ATLS. And my answer on that is ultrasound would be very useful in the smaller hospital, if two things. First, if they see enough people to accumulate and maintain the experience necessary to do the study. And then second is if they're able to act on the results of the study. It doesn't make any sense to me to do an ultrasound if there's not surgical capability to act on the results of the ultrasound. So that's what I try to teach people when we have this discussion in ATLS and the rural trauma course.
So we have, for the medical students and junior residents that are out there, what are some of the pearls and the pitfalls in terms of doing the ultrasound and some of the things that you like can be false, it can be negative, and it can lead you down a wrong path?
So when I'm working with our residents, probably the biggest thing is just practice, and to practice like you're going to do it when a sick person is there. And so one thing that for example, our residents will, as we're practicing and we're just using it on everybody who comes in, say they're having a hard time getting a left upper quadrant view, and they'll ask the patient to take a deep breath, which is fine. That helps you get the left upper quadrant view, but that isn't realistic for what's going to happen when the patient is presenting in shock. They're not going to be able to do that. So I ask that we practice the exam the way that we're going to do it when we actually really need to do it. But really, I think the big thing is do it so that you get used to how to do the exam and what a normal looks like so that you can recognize abnormal in that subset of patients.
Okay, great. And Dr. Joseph, can you give us a good rundown on what you spoke about this morning? It was a good talk on TEG, Rotem.
Really, the new thing or the new hot or hype is really whether we're using PT, PTT, and INR versus the true, what's really happening with coagulation that you can actually analyze from TEG and Rotem. And, you know, this has been around since the 1950s. The cardiac literature, the transplant literature is very strong for it. It's just introducing itself into trauma. And really, we're just learning to understand what it means in trauma patients, and then I think the next phase will be how we actually integrate that. And I mean, today what I really presented really showed that, you know, all the literature coming out, just better correlation than the conventional coagulation assays. We're understanding not just the clot formation, but the clot breakdown, as well as the hypercoagulability state. And I think, you know, we're going to get to a point where we'll have a better understanding to help resuscitate our patients and ultimately improve care.
So is understanding the only thing holding us back, or is it technology? Or?
I think technology. I think the current TEG models, including the rapid TEG versus the Rotem, I don't know if there's a better system, but I think the new TEG 6S will revolutionize because its ability, its mobility, its ease to use, interpretation, and even the way you run the sample will allow us to utilize it both pre-hospital, in the OR, in the ICUs. And, you know, as far as cost goes, once you get the system, it's the same cost as ordering the blood work. So I think it's coming, and I'm really excited about the future of this.
Yeah. If I could jump in and ask a question, I had hoped that this was going to come up on the panel. Do you think that we should do the TEG or the Rotem on all people coming in, again, so that we get used to what things look like, normal and abnormal?
You know, I think, I know you mentioned that you use the FAST sometimes to, you know, practice on all patients, but I really think a trauma activation is to put someone into a trauma activation subset, that patient is ill, and really they need to have, I think that absolutely we should be getting it, as just like we get any other blood panel work, it should be part of your blood panel, whatever that is for your trauma patient.
So, Bilal, so how do we integrate this with, you know, now we're being told one-to-one-to-one resuscitation is the way to go, which is, you know, you don't need to think about it. Yeah. So are we going to get away from one-to-one-to-one using TEG?
You know, I think what TEG will do, I think there's no absolute, it's not black or white, there's some gray in there. I think TEG will allow our resuscitation to be better and more focused. I think it will reduce the number of transfusions. We'll know what exactly to transfuse. I think the one-to-one-to-one is important initially until we start getting values. And, the one-to-one-to-one has reduced our overall crystalloid resuscitation, which we know has been killing our patients for years. And so that's what the one-to-one-to-one is. I think it's important, especially when you go to rural hospitals that don't have this technology. But I think what the TEG will do is it will allow us faster interpretation of where the patient is in their disease process and move us toward better resuscitation.
So, Bilal, how often do you find that you have discordant results between the TEG and you have standard coagulation parameters that you have? And in what side, especially now in a setting when this is all new, what side would you tell people to err on? I know you're going to look at the patient and see, did it come back late, whatnot, but what do you do about that scenario?
I could tell you that, at our institution, so we did it for research initially, and then now we use it in the OR, and our anesthesiologists run it. But, all the correlation studies where they looked at, correlation between whether or not you need a blood transfusion or massive transfusion or direct correlation between the TEG parameters and the conventional assays, TEG is superior, or Rotem, whatever, it is superior to, it correlates better. The values actually have higher AUCs under the curve that give you better correlation. So every paper you look at is extremely convincing.
So to follow up on Matt's question a little bit earlier with the 1-to-1-to-1, how will all of this change, if at all, in terms of if we're able to go to whole blood?
Yeah. I think that, injury is the disease we're treating. So injury will cause coagulopathy. The tissue breakdown causes coagulopathy. The act of bleeding causes coagulopathy. So I really think that whether or not we use whole blood or not, what we need to do is realize that we have to understand where our patient is in that whole disease process.
If I could, Bilal, ask a question of you. So you've established that TEG is good for the acute coagulopathy of trauma. is it useful at all as we look at the anticoagulant medications, the antiplatelet medications, and the novel anticoagulants?
You know, that I can tell you the preliminary data is not very convincing for the direct thrombin inhibitors of how well it correlates. I think we're still learning that. I don't think there's enough data to, you know, take one side or the other. I don't want to come off like I'm, you know, TEG is everything and it's the solution to everything. But I think that what's out there and the data that's out there and the number of patients that have been studied is very convincing that this is something that we need to make part of our practice.
What are some of the challenges you've run into just getting it up and running? Like Dr. Martin was saying, you know, one-to-one-to-one, you don't have to think about it. It's protocolized. Yeah. And that is, starting a protocolized resuscitation is hard enough to get that going in a timely manner. What about this where we're having to interpret things? What are extra resources? Yeah. What are some of the challenges?
Doctors are smart people. We'll learn to interpret like everything else. I really think that the really big resource, I think the TEG success will solve that. You know, before you had one assay for the platelets, one assay for the actual clotting cascade, and what will happen with the 6S is you'll have one cartridge, no pipetting, you know, the whole motion artifact. That was a big deal. I mean, you could bunt off the TEG and the rapid TEG. You could make the results erroneous just by having noise or bumping up on the table, and you know, it had to be in a special place with a special person. And now I think with the new technology, they've kind of listened to the people that have been using it, and they've made changes that will definitely make this more feasible.
And that was really exciting to hear about in your talk, the new 6S. What's the timetable? Can you talk a little bit about that? What's the timetable?
It's actually out there right now. I think 4 or 6 trauma centers are actually utilizing it. I met with the we are actually trying to bring it to our institution, and the company's super excited about it. I think within 6 months to a year, it's going to be approved to be out there.
So we're talking about a lot of these things in the context of trauma. Yeah. Obviously, we're here at a trauma critical care acute care surgery conference. So take me, is there a role, let's say you're, I don't know, a random surgeon out there that gets into a lot of bleeding. Let's say your name is Dr. Matt Martin. And is there a role in terms of patient comes in, whether they're septic or, you know, you crash them in the OR, you get into it, and is this going to be find its way into intraoperative resuscitation for anesthesia? Or where are we at in terms of the general surgery aspect in terms of TEG?
You know, it's been around in cardiac for over 50 years. Transplant surgeons use it religiously. I can tell you at our institution, all the noise that's been coming out from it, our OB colleagues are using it. The ED physicians are using it now for GI bleeds, resuscitation in GI bleeds. So I think that, you know, it's going to help us interpret and be better doctors.
So a question for both of you. Are you using the TEG to decide whether to give TXA or not based on fibrinolysis, or are you just given TXA based on the standard indications, which is within 3 hours in a high-risk patient?
I'll just answer first. You know, at our institution, we're still not using it based on the TEG results. We're giving it based on the less than 1 hour. But I really think that, you know, it takes time for change, and this is really a new language that we're all learning in our.
At our place, honestly, we've had a hard time incorporating TXA into our massive transfusion protocol, and the fallback now has been that TXA becomes used as we see the Rotem result, and if we see the hyperfibrinolysis. So we probably underutilize TXA, but it's because we've struggled to get it incorporated up front in our MTP.
All right, and two quick questions back to ultrasound for you, Rick. So what do you do with the unstable patient negative fast? What's your preferred modality for ruling out the abdomen?
So patient in the emergency room, unstable, negative fast, I'll repeat the fast several times, kind of keep looking through things, and try to exclude the other sources, obviously, so chest x-ray, pelvis x-ray, external hemorrhage, etc. Clinical judgment, if it's, you know, someone who has a high likelihood of abdominal injury, then that's someone who may go to the operating room. Honestly, it's sacrilegious to say, I'm not completely opposed to taking sick people to the CT scanner. I'm not completely opposed to that, and that's a little bit painful to actually admit.
So you're not doing diagnostic peritoneal aspirate for those patients?
Oh, hardly ever. I don't remember the last time that, for shock. For other indications, yeah.
You know, I just want to chime in on that. You know, I think that What I try to teach my residents is a negative fast doesn't tell you anything. It's a positive fast. But when you have a negative fast and an unstable patient, you haven't ruled out intra-abdominal injury. And before you decide whether you're going to CAT scan or OR, at our institution, DPA, we use it a lot. I mean, for a negative fast, persistently hypotensive patient who you really don't know where you need more data, I think that the DPA has its role. So it just kind of depends on how you look at that.
And then, Rick, have you integrated the EFAST looking for pneumothorax, or are you routinely doing that in your trauma patients?
So the EFAST incorporates the thoracic views looking for pneumothorax or hemothorax. And my answer is yes, I do that now. I don't think that it alters my clinical decision making all that often, but I'm still in the phase where I do it so that I acquire the skills so that when the time comes where I actually need to interpret it, that I'll be able to.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a very good point about sacrilege. It's to say death begins in radiology, right? We've heard that since the time we were medical students. But I guess my chime in would just simply say, I think it happens a heck of a lot more than we're willing to admit. And all you got to do is sit through a few M&Ms and hear, hang on, you went to radiology. I mean, we get CAT scans. That's just kind of the way that it is. And depending on it is. We're also joined by Dr. Marty Schreiber, who gave us a little bit of a sneak preview yesterday in terms of some of his stem cell. And Marty, if you want to chime in on any of the things we were just talking about before, but we'd also like you to kind of touch about what you talked about on the panel today. Very, very exciting type things that are coming up. And the listeners would really want to hear about this.
So I'm Marty Schreiber from Oregon Health and Science University. I've heard two things talked about so far. One is TXA. Our biggest problem with TXA is keeping people from using it. In fact, what we're seeing is this infectious adoption of the use of tranexamic acid in the pre-hospital setting. And patients with minor injuries, femur fractures, they're getting tranexamic acid. And it's like this infectious explosion of the use of the drug that is reminiscent of factor VII. And we're very specific about when we use it. We give it after patients have gotten 4 units of red cells in 2 hours. So I don't think it should be used pre-hospital. I think that the data about any of its use is sort of questionable. The other question I heard raised was the question of what to do in an unstable patient with a negative fast, and I think there's different kinds of unstable patients. There's the patient who's crashing in front of you, who you might even consider to take directly to the operating room. There's the patient who is hypotensive, who's fairly significantly hypotensive, who you don't want to take to the CT scanner, and that patient I would do a DPA on to confirm intra-abdominal bloods, particularly in the case of a pelvic fracture, when you're trying to determine what needs to be treated, the pelvic fracture or intra-abdominal bleeding. And then there's a third patient who's a little bit hypotensive. You give them some fluid and their blood pressure comes up, and maybe it drops a little bit, but you're able to support them fairly well with fluid. That patient, I think, can go to the CAT scanner. In terms of the topic that I talked about this morning, I've talked about the use of stem cells in trauma. I think this is a very, very exciting topic because it gives us a new avenue to treat diseases we haven't been able to treat before, such as things like traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, ARDS, compartment syndrome. These are all things where we support the patient, do what we can surgically, but then just wait for them to recover. And these are active treatment mechanisms that are utilized, and the source of stem cells are diffuse. They include tissues themselves like brain, spinal cord, bone marrow, skin, as well as blood. Stem cells are actually a blood product. It's very early into this technology, but they have been studied in a number of areas like traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, ARDS, wound healing, lung injury, bone marrow failure. And there's evidence of success and improved outcomes in patients who receive stem cells in all of these areas. There's still a ton of things we don't know, like what cells to use, when to give them, what the dosage of the cells needs to be, what the source of the cell should be, and there's a lot of room still for basic science work and work in animals, although the studies in humans are ongoing.
Now, Dr. Schreiber, one of my favorite quotes from your talk was, we should be saving our future children's placentas for future stem cell use. And I thought that was amazing. Now, I mean, that kind of shows that you feel like this is very strongly going to be prevalent in the future. Now, what are the barriers? You already mentioned we are not there quite yet with the basic science of technology. Are there any legal barriers to this in stem cell research?
The biggest area is with the area of embryonic stem cells. So, you know, using embryonic stem cells from fetuses in general is an area that is considered questionably ethical. So that area, the important thing here is that the younger the cells, probably the more effective they'll be. So the embryonic stem cells, not only are they pluripotent, which means that they can recreate any tissue in the human body, which is, you know, why fetuses don't make scars. It's because of their embryonic stem cells. So they have the greatest potential, but are the ones that have the greatest ethical questions. And there's even been laws made against using stem cells in those scenarios. But there's no problem with, for instance, taking a patient's own blood, generating stem cells from your own blood, from your bone marrow, from your skin. There's absolutely no ethical concern there. And even using them like a blood bank. So, you know, from other patients, as long as the patient is consenting and giving their tissues, there's no issues there. The real issues are in the embryonic area.
Now, you mentioned in your talk that this is something that nobody in the room had probably heard of, and I think that's true. I think back, you know, around Christopher Reeve's time, everybody kind of heard of stem cells for spinal cord regeneration, but its use and application for ARDS and compartment syndrome. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm sure that's something most of our listeners are completely unaware of or unfamiliar with.
So the studies in ARDS began in about 2005, 2006, started in mouse models, advanced through to rodent models and then swine models, and then proceeded to isolated human lung models. Both phase one and phase two trials have now been done in humans. The phase one trial is completed. It showed that the stem cells were safe and there was evidence of improved outcomes. The phase two trial is about two-thirds finished and is ongoing as we speak.
Marty, three questions for you. How costly is this? How close are we to prime time use of all that? And then what's, if anything, is the downside to that? But apart from the ethical issues, is there some morbidity associated with some of these things?
So I'll address your last question first. So all of these areas that have been studied in humans, spinal cord injury, ARDS, these areas have all been through phase one trials, so the cells have been given to normal patients without evidence of adverse outcomes. So to date, right now, there are no known adverse outcomes associated with the use of stem cells. In terms of the cost, this is a rapidly changing area that, you know, it's difficult to estimate. It depends how the stem cells are obtained. The process for purifying the stem cells takes about 6 or 7 hours. It's not overly complex, and it's not that different from like a stem cell transplant that's a bone marrow transplant given to cancer victims. So it's within the realm of what's commonly done in medical therapies. And then how close to prime time? The farthest anybody has gone in humans is phase two trials. So I think prime time will probably happen after phase three trials. So we're looking at somewhere probably in the range of 5 to 10 years until this would be widely used.
So is there a spectrum to all this stuff where you have a baby, you take some of their placenta or some of the cord or anything, and you just freeze dry it, and that's yours for the future, and you just go to your bank where you get that later on when you have problems? I mean, is that the future? Is that what we're going to see?
It's actually the present. So these stem cell banks are already happening. So you can do this. You can take your fetus's placenta and you can store it in a blood bank, in a stem cell bank. That technology exists and people are doing it.
Yeah, and having just had twins 1 year ago, it's a huge issue now. You're offered the option of storing their cord blood, and you know it's several thousand dollars, but they dangle that in front of you. If there's some future disease that can be treated with their stem cells, you have that option. And there's a lot of controversy about it because they haven't had any cases yet where people have actually used that, so people are saying it's an unnecessary expense. But I agree with Marty. With how much progress is being made, you know, that's an option you should strongly consider because I think the future is huge for stem cells.
Did you do it? You don't have to tell. You did.
Wow.
So to the three of you, we wind up with a one-liner, and what I would say is that obviously the session itself was new and old technology, hot or hype, so fill in the blank. So the thing that will be essentially all hype in the next 5 years regarding trauma is?
Tranexamic acid.
Well, Marty, you took exactly what I was going to say. And your analogy with factor VII is very, very fitting, I think.
Probably going to get shot for this, but I really think Roboa is going to be all hype.
All right, well, thanks for joining us on Behind the Knife. We enjoy the rest of the conference. We look forward to having you all back on the show.
Well, that does it for us today at Behind the Knife. We hope you enjoyed two of the great panel discussions discussing those controversial topics. Another great shout out to East TraumaCast for helping us get this all organized. Tomorrow we'll be reviewing about half a day of the conference and hopefully ending with Dr. Maddox giving his final speech.
Until next time, dominate the day.